This is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening. Welcome. I'm Stephanie Vaughn, representing the Creative Writing Program, and welcoming Michael Silverblatt, whom I was very happy to meet yesterday, having been on leave when he made a much celebrated appearance here last winter. I want to tell you that John Lennon's interview of the interviewer is now available as a podcast on the Creative Writing site. And of course, I want to thank our two anonymous donors, without whose generosity we would not be here, and without whose generosity Michael Silverblatt would not be here. For the past 21 years, Michael Silverblatt has been host of the national public radio show Bookworm, which is broadcast about once a week from KCRW in Santa Monica, and which is available for downloading if you happen to be unlucky enough, as we now are, not to have it on our local radio station owing to the Bush administration's history. His disembodied voice, according to more than one poster on the internet, is so seductive, so hypnotic, so compelling that it apparently has prevented people driving on the LA freeways from committing acts of road rage. In 21 years, he has interviewed over 1,000 writers, and maybe you could tell us the number. I've read that it's over 1,200. And before interviewing them, he has read all of their books, not just the book that's coming out that month. Not only has he read all of their books, but, and I'm just guessing from some of the questions he asked, he seems to have read the books the writers read before they wrote their books. And I learned today, a couple of hours ago, that you've also listened to the music that writers listen to when they're composing. I have testimony from one of our graduate students that you told him what he had been listening to when he was working on his novel. Writers are constantly expressing their gratitude to him for his insights about their own work. Quite memorably, David Foster Wallace, the late David Foster Wallace, was so stunned by Michael Silverblatt's characterization of his project that after half a beat of silence, he asked Michael Silverblatt if he would adopt him. What characterizes his conversations is his ability to strip himself of pretense and reveal the ways that he is reading a writer's work with his entire conscious mind, as well as his own history. And I remember he began the interview with Juno Diaz on the occasion of the publication of Oscar Wilde, the book that won the Pulitzer, by saying that he, Michael Silverblatt, was Oscar Wilde, that he too read a lot of science fiction, and that he too was a nerd. That was the word that you used, as I recall. He is as open to intellectual experience as anyone I could name, living or dead. He is capable also of profound empathy, which is to say that both his mind and his heart are colossal, and that he brings to writers and to books an affirmation that living inside a good narrative or living inside a good poem, your story or your poem, if he happens to be talking to you, is the only way really to exist on this planet. And this week, during his residency here, he is bringing this big heart and big mind to the work of all 16 of our MFA students. Some of you already know, some of you are about to learn, that he is modest and self-deprecating while still remaining candid and sincere. I think it's unusual to find a sincere self-deprecation. He happened to say at dinner last night that his name contained the syllable blat, which could be extended to blather, which is what he said he did, only he would characterize his articulacy that way. But it reminded me, when I woke up this morning, I didn't have a rejoinder at dinner, Michael, I thought of one this morning. I was reminded that your first name is the name of an archangel in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and that Michael, of course, is the one who led the armies against Satan. And Satan, if I could paraphrase you, I hope you'll forgive me for this, Satan, I think we might characterize him as those readers you were talking about who did not read with affection and who read to ridicule. He has said that he never interviews a writer whose work he doesn't admire. And he's also said that there are enough people who are turning people away from reading and that he does not want to be one of them. So let us welcome with much warmth and affection the archangel named Saint Michael Silverberg. Thank you.
I always feel happier and safer when I see something that looks like a microphone because I spend so much of my life in front of one and didn't entirely expect to. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah? Easily and well? Fully? Because there is a microphone that can be used. And there's enough water here. I have, you know, papers inside here, but I'm not going to read from them. I don't really believe in it. I never was able to spend very much time listening to lectures. I am able to attend to readings most of the time, but I had such a weird situation. I used to, in classes in college, I went to the State University of New York at Buffalo. I used to sit and write down every word that the professor said because it wasn't what they had to teach that interested me. It was how they said it. I had at Buffalo inexplicably, unaccountably, what has to have been the most astonishing assemblage of minds and speakers, and might I add, funny voices, that I've ever encountered. And let me name them because they really account for me. I went there to be a math major. This was a compromise. My parents would have liked me to be a business major. I had no interest whatever. And fortunately, in those days, liberal arts colleges didn't tend to have business departments, so they were completely out of luck. They couldn't force me into it. And the year I got there, it was 1969, and they were in the midst of the second year of the so-called revolution. So classes were frequently suspended. We got to have our classes often, if at all, at our professors' houses, which meant, really, that most of the math classes were completely suspended because there were 200 people in the lecture hall, whereas English classes tended to have 16 or so. And I completely fell in love with John Barth, Donald Barthelme, Dwight MacDonald, René Girard, Michel Foucault, John Coetzee, Robert Haas, Robert Creeley, John Logan, Irving Feldman, Carl Dennis, all of them there and teaching at the same time and constantly. It was not yet the case that a teacher taught one out of every three semesters or four semesters. They were there to be encountered and could be visited at home. Foucault, in particular, was teaching for the first time in America. At that time, only his book, Madness and Civilization, in an abridged edition, was available. Buffalo was thought to be one of those hotbeds of structuralism and post-structuralism because we had many people who had studied with Richard Maxey from Johns Hopkins, and René Girard had moved to Buffalo, the author of Deceit, Desire, and the novel. So the school truly did what it intended to do when it announced itself as the show place of the new Nelson Rockefeller State University system. They wanted, the English department did, to model themselves on Black Mountain. Black Mountain was a college down south where many, many poets studied together. I mean, extraordinary poets. And at one time, it was one of the major schools of American poetry, the Black Mountain School. And Creeley was down there, and Joel Oppenheimer and others. It was an interesting place because Charles Olson, a very great poet, was the dean. And they wanted to have as many artists as they had scholars. In other words, as many practitioners as interpreters. And Buffalo did too. As a result, for me, it, and not Disneyland, was the happiest place on earth. I never encountered so much and so constant a level of intellectual penetration. Penetration, I would say, under duress, because with the revolution, people were constantly being bopped on the head with tear gas canisters or being arrested for protests. This included the professors. I don't think at any time in American education professors were as close to their students in feeling and behavior as they were then. My life was utterly changed. My deepest interest in literature had come because my mother, as usual, had refused to give me what I wanted. Don't take that in any secondary meaning. We would go to the beauty parlor together, and I would sit around while she was under those dryers. And next door, there was a place called Our Baby Shop, where there was a big version of Disney's Alice in Wonderland, a book, huge. And I wanted it so much. I loved the pictures. And my mother went in, and she insists, and I know it's true, that she bought me the real Lewis Carroll Alice in Wonderland, not because it was a work of literature and better than the Disney version, but because it was less expensive. I mean, we were the quintessence of a thrifty family. My mother was the child of immigrants. Her sisters and brothers had been born in Russia. Her mother had been born in Russia. They saved, I mean, still, I just visited the house. The visit to Cornell made it possible for me to see my mother. They were as thrifty as you can imagine, this involving reuse of tea bags and silver tinfoil and bags. And if the pencil ran down to its nub, they kept the eraser. And we still have drawers of these things, drawers of erasers, drawers. An incredible thing in its own way. I am a dreamer, and in my imagination, a lavish person, in that I have always bought myself whatever book I wanted to read next, and they're pleased to me that we go instead to the library, or why do you need more books, or don't you have enough already, were constant. I mean, you know, I had a post office route. You could take a test and work for the civil service during the summer. So my first year in college gave me a post office route, and my parents forever after believed that I'd missed my calling. Why won't you work for the post office, they said. You'll have security, you'll get advances, there's a pension. I mean, this is what I grew up with really, really, really all the way until last year when Oprah magazine wrote a piece about me, O magazine, and my parents and aunts and uncles and cousins finally decided that if I was good enough for Oprah, I was good enough for them. I mean, they started, for the first time in my life, to ask me questions about what I do, to ask me if I'd read this or that. It was as if I'd given them permission. These were people, you have to understand, who hoped that the first baby born to a cousin would have as his first words, hockey puck. They would sit there saying, hockey puck, and rooting for him, you know, that it would come out before Papa or Mama. I mean, it was insane. Friends who would come to visit for holidays would say to me, do you realize that none of them spoke to you the entire time we were there? I say, yes, it's quite often the case. They don't know what to say to me. And I didn't know what to say to them. And my uncle, German, by profession, a butcher, would say to me, eerily, given what he sold, what's the matter, cat got your tongue? Because I was equally shy and terrified. And somehow or other, it wasn't until I got to college that I bloomed, but only really in private, because I would wait until the class was over and then go up to talk to the teacher, because I didn't want to say anything in the class. I had been once singled out as a, pardon me, but that passionate, seductive voice is something of a myth. At first, what I was famous for was not having a radio voice. And the speech teacher who used to come around to classes in public schools caught me. I have the one letter I have trouble with three times in my name, Michael Silverblatt, L's, and I was caught to have a lazy L. I still do. And so I was afraid that someone else would hear the laziness of this L. And, you know, you remember when Carrie is hearing, they'll all laugh at you? They'll all laugh at you. They'll all laugh at you. That's the way I felt. Every day was the prom, and they'll all laugh at me. And I just kept my thing, whatever it is, under a rock, except in the presence of John Barth and Donald Barthelme, these people who I'd read. It never occurred to me that you needed to have courage to speak to these people. As far as they were I was concerned, because they had written what they'd written, and because I had responded to it so intensely, they were my friends. They didn't know it yet. But they were not going to escape my love. Especially Barth, because when I read that book, on the mail route, it was the Gracie Mansion mail route in New York City. That's where I lived. And there were many, many of my first encounter, this is my freshman year, of the many rare and used bookstores there used to be in New York. So many on that one mail route. And I bought The Complete Works of Dickens, a book dealer's son who hated books said to me, waggling a copy of TikTok of Oz. It was a first edition, and I loved the Oz books, all of them. Who would you kill to get a copy of this? And I found it so interesting, you know, that I would keep going back there. He was a chess master. You know, this was a world that I yearned to enter, that New York City world of eccentricity and literariness. It seemed everywhere around me. And on the subway or waiting on the steps for something to open, I would hold my book like a badge in the hope that someone would talk to me. You know, I've read that book. How are you liking that book? Would you lend me that book when you're finished with anything? And there in Buffalo, for the first time in my whole life, there were people who wrote books. I never met an author before. And that the author was the author I read the summer before I went to Buffalo, John Barth, mostly because people would say to me, "Oh, Buffalo, I hear John Barth is there." And I had no idea who he was, but my friend and I read The Sotweed Factor and The Gyroscope Boy, and I never, even though I'd read all of Dickens, great deals of Dostoevsky, I'd never read anything as complicated before. I didn't think a human being had written it. I thought it was, and now we are in the age, I thought it was post-human. I thought that the man I would meet when I was so eager in my first week of college to run there to see, I thought his head would sprout from a shoulder. I thought he'd have a macrocephalic hand dangling from the other shoulder. I thought that the scariest thing was someone who was that weird, looked like an ordinary human being with a suntan from having been away for the summer. It was the first thing I learned, really, that writers were not what they looked like, that you could encounter someone who'd created a rogue's gallery of grotesque and amorals who looked just like you or I. I mean, it really did surprise me because I thought it should be somehow incised on someone's face, their acquaintance with amorality. I mean, John Barth, I mean, ruined my years from 16, when I arrived at college, to 21, when I left college. It took me a long time to graduate. I didn't want to leave. Why? Because his basic thing was that the realm of possibilities of choice was so beautiful, was so great, that to choose one thing to do was inevitably disappointing, and that therefore, paralysis was the preferred mode of being. And I thought there was no way to disagree with this. It was so obviously true. And I paralyzed myself. I developed a writing block. Anything that you can think of that would not come to the aid of a young man in college, I learned from these John Barth books and adopted as credos, as a way of life. I was very grateful when he went on leave and Barthelme came in, because you see, from Barth I learned that you shouldn't believe what you learn from a book. A book is not necessarily there to tell you the truth. A book is there to make your life more difficult. The greatest books make life and thought, to my mind, this is not true of all books, for me, the books I loved the most made it harder for me to live. Somehow I appreciated finding life difficult because I am one who does not think that the earth was made for us. I think that we are, first to last, strangers on it, and that it takes us a good first half of our life just to get used to gravity. You know, that it's not easy. I always tell the suicidal young people that I know and meet that they're not wrong, that it's hard to live here. And I used to, you don't want me to go into this very deeply, it's not very pleasant, but that is my way of being alive. And I equally well know that thinking is so immersive for me that I will never kill myself. I'll be interrupted by a thought I want to finish first. It's not in my destiny for that, although I've been nearly convinced over and over. Fortunately, my favorite person who ever lived on Earth, my grandmother, lived to be 100 years old. And I have an aunt, her daughter, my mother's sister, who's now 101. She can remember who I am for 10 seconds at a time. And my mother, to make sure that her sister understood who she was talking to this weekend, said, "What do you remember about Michael?" very loudly so my aunt could hear. And my aunt said, "Michael with the books!" That way we knew that she knew who I was. Maybe who I am. It was true. I read while walking down the street, mothers would call my mother to warn her that I would befall dire automobiles would befall me. I'd be fallen by dire automobiles. Something bad would happen. But I think I developed antennae. You know what I mean? The ability to walk without seeing in places I knew. And I loved doing it. As far as I was concerned, I couldn't read enough. And there in college, when I learned that Buckminster Fuller practiced something called, I believe, either tensegrity sleep or dimaxion sleep, but what it meant was that he'd sleep from 15 minutes to half an hour four times a day, and that was all he needed. And so I, from my sophomore to senior year of college, not the fifth year, but the middle three, I slept for around 2 hours a day so that I would have more time to read. I read very, very slowly, I have to say, and that's why I needed the time. I was, of course, as you might suspect from what I'm saying, thought to be an autistic child. And they kept having to make decisions about where to put me in my education, with so-called special children or with otherwise called gifted children. Gifted special. So, you know, and really there was equal justification for both. I couldn't walk up or down stairs without putting both feet on the same step. This took me until junior high. You know, there was no secret that could be kept about my inability to control my bladder. You know, all the things that happened to children happened to me, and occasioned teasing, which made me put a book in front of my face so I wouldn't see the people when they were making fun of me. And I didn't really think that there was anything particularly wrong. I didn't like when they conspired to be nice to me. I once heard a bunch of the worst bullies planning to pretend to be as bad at baseball as I was, and that therefore I would be the best on the team, and wouldn't this make me feel better? And I thought, oh, God, I hope they don't. Please don't make me go through that. While they all pretended not to play ball. I didn't want it. I don't want anyone's kindness, really, when it comes to that. I want to be understood for my gifts. I don't want to be deplored for my absence of ability. There are very few things I do well. This is one of them. Talking, reading, caring, being hurt when it seems necessary to be hurt, crying when tears are necessary because of hurt or because of being moved to tears. I think people who don't cry, and in public, are unnatural. I think given the conditions under which we now live, not to cry is to be called and not answer. You know, it's just a very strange world. When I was in college, as I said, I met all these writers and all these others would visit them there. All the students of Charles Olson made pilgrimages to Buffalo to visit the place where he had lived a good part of his life. He struck me as being the ideal liver. He lived in the motel across the street from the campus, and when his room got too full of books, his students would come and clear the room, and he'd move to the next room. Of the people who have lived this way, I know of only De Quincey, who's also a favorite writer of mine. When writers tell me about their favorite books, I immediately go to read them. Norman Mailer once told me that his favorite novelist as a boy had been a writer named Jeffrey Farnall, F-A-R-N-O-L, who wrote hundreds of boys' adventures in the Walter Scott mode. So I immediately went to get, they were the worst things, but I couldn't stop reading them. It was absolutely true. If you believed in ridiculous escapes from, you know, castles with moats and princesses to rescue, there was no one like Jeffrey Farnall. I mean, there was no stopping me. I read most of Tobias Smollett because John Barth had once written the introduction to one of his books called Roderick Random. And the mind of John Barth was such an undecodable thing to me that anything I knew he had read was of interest to me. I always thought that if I could fill my mind to the brim, that I would be able to become or impersonate one of the writers I loved. And I didn't know that nothing that I could do would give me their gift. Now, because I had come to college wanting to be a math major out of Lewis Carroll, who, when I found Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, and they made such a difference to me. Why? Because I didn't understand them. They were made for incomprehension in their time, to begin with, but in my time, all those poems that are parodied, they're not known to us. The book gets stranger and stranger and stranger with the years. You know, now that no one knows poetry by heart, all these people being asked by Tweedledee and Tweedledum to recite poems, or the Red Queen, or the Caterpillar, everyone asks Alice to recite a poem. How strange that has become, and yet it was once as normal as the sunrise. I became interested in that too, you know, like what were these poems that Alice supposedly knew by heart that were being twisted into Wonderland language? Well, there it was easy because the annotated Alice printed the original versions of all those poems, whether they were by Wordsworth or Tennyson or who have you. But then when I'd read them, See, my father was always willing, if I wouldn't buy a book, to drive me to the library at any time to get the book. And the next thing I needed was Lewis Carroll's other children's books. And those were only horrible things called Sylvie and Bruno and Sylvie and Bruno Concluded. It was because he felt that the Alice books were too crazy and irreligious. These are sentimental, treacly things with imp children who speak with various lisps and speech impediments. I woo-woo! And, you know, it was just awful. So I decided to read Lewis Carroll's real books, which were math books. He was a mathematician. And I taught myself logic and symbolic logic in particular using Lewis Carroll's textbooks. So I thought I'd be a thrilling math major and, you know, that I would be happy for the rest of my life proving things that are not true. And I became, in Buffalo, not a passionate reader. This is how to become a passionate reader. All of the books I loved, it turned out, were really ultimately chess games. And it took me not just my undergraduate years, but my graduate years to get to the point when I finally understood that I was not a wide reader, that my favorite books were all versions of the same book. Nabokov's Pale Fire, you know, they were great books, unquestionably, by great writers. But if you gave me a book about how to marry and live and die, I didn't want to read it. I didn't want to know anything about the real world. I only wanted the reimagined world, the re-represented world. And that was when I understood, it was the first year I was given the show, that there were not 52 books a year by John Barth being published. That in the interim, minimalism had occurred, and that people weren't even writing all that many books in this manner or reading them when they were published. They were, you know, sort of aberrancies in the new world. And most important, that if I didn't start being willing to experience books about the disappointments of the heart, that I wasn't really a literary person, that I was a fan. I mean, I am an ecstatic and an enthusiast, as well as a depressive. But I did not want to be a fan. And I keep meeting young men who want to become reviewers, literary critics in the old sense, not scholars, but people who write reviews in magazines. And what do they want to review? They want to review Tom McCarthy. They want to, any time a book is more intellectual than anything else, these are the books that particularly appeal to the young man who wants to be a book reviewer. And I've taken to telling them, you will never be anything. Your impulse is no different from wanting to write a column on mysteries or a column on science fiction unless you can start to read and care about the books that are emotionally sated, preferably oversating. I was so surprised after having pretended to read it all my life at what a great book Wuthering Heights is. And the level of the emotional sadism practiced among the characters. And everything that Heathcliff says in that book is so cruel and beyond human feeling. I could barely believe it. You know, that these sisters on that moor used to invent fairy stories together. I immediately read the poetry, you know, about Gondel, the imaginary land that the Brontes wrote, sometimes together, sometimes apart. I became very, very eager to experience. It was as if whoever you are, I think, you begin your life one way, but you must make a decision that turns you in the opposite direction, or perhaps you will never complete yourself. That gradually, I figured out, you know, how not to be ashamed of crying, or to own the years of being thought retarded, or, you know, all of those things, that it was all true, that what I wanted to avoid was what I had to understand. The fantasy world of that kind of chess literature, or Alice in Wonderland, or, you know, you could name them by the hundreds. It starts in the 18th century, you know, the game book. That it was excluding literally the confessional. And the confessional was the other side, for a period of time, of intellectual poetry. So it seemed always that if you loved John Ashbery, you couldn't love Lowell or Sylvia Plath. And I thought, but what if you could? I mean, what really if you could love everything as deeply as people are said to? In fact, what if you decided that instead of Buddhist dispassion toward everything, you would develop, intentionally and otherwise, a capacity for loving as many different things as possible? What if you made this your human goal? And I can't begin to name to you the number of places in which this is useful and the number of rescues I feel that I perform without horse or moat or castle or princess. No Jeffrey Farnell for me. Rescue of people who are sad. An older woman, I think someone in her 70s, said, you know, I love your show, but you always sound like you're crying. And I said, don't you like to cry? And she said, not when there's nothing wrong. And I said, that's the best time. You know, how wonderful to have the consolation of tears when nothing is wrong. So I still find, for better and worse, that I live at odds to the folk around me. You know, that no, well, plenty of people choose to live this way, but they don't say so. And that as a result, I'm as fantastical a creature as anything in Oz or in Wonderland, that, you know, I like it if people can say I never met anyone like him, and by that they should mean that it was not an unpleasant experience. For some reason, you know, a poet that no one reads anymore, but who I still like, and I like his novels too, and I like his plays, so it's unaccountable. I like his poetry, to be honest, the least. E. E. Cummings. When I read that thing, I sing of Olaf Glad and Big, and about a soldier. And, you know, he defects, and he says, there is some shit I will not eat. And you think, how do you stress that? There is some shit I will not eat. 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 But all the ways of stressing it are my ways of living. You know, that I won't accept certain behaviors, that I won't be a part of certain impulses that people have to victimize people like me and people like us by telling us that we'll never make a living, that we'll never be among others and be able to stand up straight, that teaching has become a lonely and despicable and not well-paying profession. I believe that I will find ways to make all those things, help make all those things untrue, because the people of value to me are the people who don't believe that and live their life by different lights. I suspect many in this room are of this kind of person, and I thank you for being that and for being here to listen to me. Thank you. I'm very open to any kind of question imaginable. Don't think that there's anything I won't try at least to answer irresponsibly. Yes.
You've been in Los Angeles now for what, 25 years?
31 years.
And yet you said that New York was this the world you wanted, the New York culture and literary world was...
Okay, yes. Why if New York was the place that I loved and the people that I, you know, showed me the way? Most of New York's intellectuals had children, and those children were getting every job I wanted. It was very simple. I'd go to Farrah, Straus, and Giroux on Donald Barthelme's recommendation for an editorial job, and Susan Sontag's son had the job. Or Irving Howe's, or so-and-so's. Everywhere I went, I was also afraid that as a result, you see, nepotism did not represent the extreme idealism I believe in. I believe in idealism both in the, you know, common way of saying it, in that I'm naively optimistic about things, but I believe also in idealism in the sense that I read and love Fichte and the German idealist philosophers. I'm not at all sure that the world exists, and I'd rather think that it didn't. At this stage, I'd rather think this was a nightmare I was having and not be prone to believing that others are being subjected to it. But, you know, I believe along that line that my job is a dream, that somehow or other the possibility that I could spend my days and nights reading and thinking, and when talking to writers. I think, yes, that in the culture we're living in, it's entirely inappropriate for people on radio and television to be berating and insulting books. There are enough of them to like, and they're just hastening the inevitable, that within an imaginable future, which was once completely unimaginable, there will be large, huge numbers of people not reading, do not want to read, hating reading, although having been taught what Hans Magnus Enzensberger calls second-order illiteracy. They can read the newspaper, they can work with an instruction manual, they can keep a bank book balanced, they can pay their taxes, but they can't read something they don't understand. Why? Because incomprehension was never taught to them. Because they grew up reading Run, Dog, Run, 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 Go, Dog, Go. You can't not understand it. You can learn how to read, but there's no reason to reread it. And all of our children virtually are taught this way. It was not the way they always were taught. They were taught, my mother was, my grandmother was, in addition to how to read, there were readers that contained things that were impossible for a child to read. Do you know that both here in America and in England, a second to fourth grade reader contained the fairy scenes from A Midsummer Night's Dream, Wordsworth, light reading were Poe stories, essays by Emerson, essays by, unfortunately, Carlyle. You can imagine, I don't much like Carlyle. And that what you learned by having that reader from second to fourth grade was that in fourth grade you could read things that you couldn't read in second grade. That the light came on, that what was once incomprehensible and painful to feel your way through, what once you had to go to the dictionary for every other word, became readable and enjoyable. And in, you know, sixth grade, maybe you did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream and you were in it and you heard the whole story. And because you were so used to the fairies, you knew already in sixth grade that the wrangling between Titania Oberon and their court was the same as the wrangling amongst the groundlings fighting about who will play what and the four lovers in the forest. That a child could understand this if he knew the fairy scenes well enough. I've spoken to, among others, Drury Graham about whether we couldn't perhaps go into schools and spend time teaching works that the students are too young to understand. Because what does a teacher have to be in order to teach those things? Passionate, wildly caring, so interesting and exciting that you can hold a classroom rapt while they try to read something they're not going to be able yet to understand. This was how people grew more thoughtful when they got older. We teach people not to get it the first day you're taught it. We're going to arrange it all in order, and by the time you leave first grade, you'll be a reader. And then in second grade, you'll read things equally stupid, but a little bit harder. And third grade, fourth grade, probably forever, until you're reading an actual work of literature. And by then, I would submit that it's too late for most people, unless they're also reading at home, unless their parents also read. But what you've learned in school is to master what you're given virtually as soon as you see it, because if you don't, you'll fall behind and make trouble for the teacher. A slow learner is the bane of the classroom, as, fascinatingly, now, is a fast learner. A kid, and I, you know, like mentor kids around LA, and, you know, people who, like, meet me and ask me if I'll be there, I'm sure. I mean, how could you say no? Kids who read a lot at home and come into history class having questions because they've read more probably than the teacher are slowing the class down. The teacher doesn't want you to know things in great detail. The teacher wants to know and test you on only things in the textbook and his or her lesson plan. I have watched really brilliant kids be sent to schools for problem children because they are not able to sit still and learn just what they're told. It is so crazy now. So that I have to tell you, when I got sent all of these packets and manuscripts from you, that when I read them, I honestly say that whatever I mean it in my way, that in every single manuscript that I read, and in many cases reread and reread again, because it's not respectful to talk to a writer without knowing the work. Although that is what's done on Charlie Rose or on Fresh Air, someone else reads it and gives the list of questions to the host, who doesn't have the time to do that reading because the program's on every day. How could they, right? Therefore, the book section of any of these popular shows is always the least interesting section, because the host has seen the movie. The host has listened to the record. That only took 40 minutes. The host can't be uninformed about politics. His viewers and listeners will tell him and write in and have a problem. So this host gets to slide when it comes to books and poetry, and much as that bookseller waggled the copy of the Oz book at me, there was Charlie Rose sitting across from Harold Bloom, lifting up a copy of one of the many Bloom books, saying, "So Harold, what is this about?" Any of you who grow up and are lucky enough to get a publisher to send you on a tour, until you get to me, most of the people who talk to you will not have had time to read the book unless you have inadvertently become already as popular as the very most popular writers. Why would that be? Because if a book is a bestseller, the host had better read it because his listeners may have read it. And if he makes errors or flubs, they'll know. These people never want to be ashamed. If I were one of those people who didn't have a chance to read the work in question, it's where I begin the interview. I have not read this book, and I am talking to you with ignorance. I do not want my listeners to confuse talk born out of ignorance with taught born out of perception and time. But we're not thought to be worthy of this confidence. I mean, I find this such a difficult thing that, you know, it got to the point. They used to talk about, what was it called, the Peter Principle, that people were promoted until they got to the point where they could no longer do their job well. Then they stopped being promoted. But this is like, you know, you get a show that's on one day a week, then you get a show that's on every day, and then you're supposed to cover everything from the news to sports to books, and you are, as you work this way, less and less informed about everything you say and know, and these become, in turn, our most famous commentators. How could we expect any different? Why are we so crazy as not to demand that specialists in each area cover each area? Because we've gotten used to a kind of complacency, and because we don't want to be feeling incomprehension. You could listen to television, radio, read newspapers, and most magazines, popular magazines, and never encounter something you don't understand. Do you understand what a nightmare that makes life? Because we all know secretly that there's very little going on in the world that's easy to understand anymore. Certainly not in science, certainly not in math. Those people who used to be able to transform this incomprehensible material into things that we could begin to understand were called teachers, and we don't respect them by and large. What I'm trying to do on the radio, you see, the general manager of my station had been married to a poet. Not only a poet, but the first person to translate Mayakovsky and Artaud in America, a man named Jack Hirschman. He was, for a time, the poet laureate of San Francisco. Published by City Lights. So when a person from one of the major networks was appointed to the board of KCRW and was welcomed to the board, he stood up and said that he loved being invited to join the board of KCRW And he loved KCRW, except for Bookworm, where the idea of talking to one writer for a whole half an hour. I mean, what's the point of talking to someone hearing this conversation about a book you haven't read? I.e., the conversation couldn't possibly be interesting in its own right. It had to be referring to an experience he wouldn't be having, didn't intend it to have, reading the book. And my general manager had the bravery and dear courage. Was a person like me, who was able to say, if you think that Bookworm is the show that you would like to change on KCRW, you may be on the board of the wrong station, because we regard it as our flagship show, as our brand. We would like people to listen to KCRW because they listen to Bookworm. It's what allows us to play music when we play music, to move in new directions. As long as Bookworm is there, we will have the world of the intellect and the emotional world covered. I felt, when people told me this, they mostly told it to me spitefully, I have to tell you. When people told me this, I was so happy, you know. When Barnes & Noble wanted to sponsor the show, you see, this is why I believe in idealism. They were offering around $150,000 to the station to sponsor the show in all the places that it aired. And I went to my general manager and said, most of the people who listen to the show patronize independent bookstores, and it would be inherently contemptuous of the people who own independent bookstores who actually carry the books by the writers I'm talking to have Barnes & Noble be the sponsor. It's wrong. I don't want the money, and they're already talking to me about covering Barnes & Noble's discovery books. Now, most of the discovery novels by Barnes & Noble are not bad, and I probably could find some I'd be willing to cover, but as far as I'm concerned, no one gets to tell me what to cover. I don't want to have a half hour of my berating an author whose work I don't like. There are plenty of other people to do it for me. Plenty of places in the culture where that kind of derision is regarded as what criticism is at its best. When I read something like Book Forum, you know, which is probably the best remaining review outlet in America, it is. And the writers are often brilliant, and they've been graduate students in English or whatever subject they're covering, but they never allow themselves to go over the moon about anything. There's never enthusiasm. You know, spend no time, let no beats of the heart, no more beats of the heart occur than necessary before you get this book, because it will change you. Be sure, you know, they don't do that kind of reviewing. It's always a kind of very intelligent, but a little bit tepid, and you'd better know the range of references. I could talk to a room of people of very various intelligence and know that most of them had understood me, if not every word, the words that would help them to understand. Intellectuals tend no longer to talk that way. Next question.
Debbie, sorry, if you need to say something, go ahead. Go ahead, ask the next question. I was going to say, as you spoke, I just redesigned the entire English curriculum. We should no longer have courses called Milton or Modern Poetry. We should have all modern courses called What Ashbery Read, What Hoover Read. And that's how you get your literary tradition, by that organic way of following the breadcrumb trail left by writers of our own time. So what do you think of that as the Silverbladian redesign of English studies?
As long as it would include what Dickens read, Because Dickens, as it happened, loved Tobias Smollett beyond all other writers. That writer I mentioned that I'd read because I saw John Barth's name on the introduction of the book, and what Milton read, and what John Donne read, and where that kind of metaphorical structure came from. As long as you did it always that way, and go further and further into the past. Yes, when I was a chess-playing reader, I read Ada, and I, you know, read Ada with incomprehension and couldn't understand Ada, and would hear people later on, like Martin Amis, say that this was, you know, Nabokov's big mistake. I kept wanting originally to talk only about people who'd been at Cornell, and I had all sorts of things to say about Pynchon and Nabokov and Ammons, but then I thought deference goes only so far. I'm talking to all of you anyway, so that's enough respect being paid. But I read for such a long time books only because they were parodied or travestied in Ada, say. I read Chateaubriand, I read René and Atala, the book that takes place in America. I read H.G. Wells's odd novel, The Passionate Friends, and then because I didn't like it and I hadn't read much H.G. Wells, I'd read a book that Marilyn Robinson mentioned in an essay called Tono Bungay, and I liked that even much, much more. I read the French Romantic poets. I'm not even going to remember most of their names. Coppé, is that one? And, you know, a whole lot. And then I had to go and find the translations of these poets. And sometimes in Ada, when Ada came out in paperback, Vladimir Nabokov, under the name of Vivian Darkbloom, which is an anagram of Vladimir Nabokov, wrote notes. And he tells us that the sentence that told us that Ada and her, I think it's cousin, Lucette, were wearing yellow-blue Voss gowns. That if you said yellow blue Voss, you'd be saying I love you in Russian. So it's not just translation, it's transliteration of the sound. Louis Zukofsky thought it would be so worthwhile that he didn't translate Catullus into English. He gave us English words which read aloud would sound the way Catullus sounds read in Latin, another kind of translation. The world is, what is it, larger, Horatio? What's that thing in Hamlet?
There are things in heaven and earth.
There are things in heaven and earth. Say it.
There are more things in heaven and earth. No, wait, am I getting the right,
the,
is that the right reference?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What?
There are more things in heaven and earth.
Horatio. Horatio doesn't believe in ghosts. There are more things in heaven and earth than in your philosophy, Horatio. Or that amazing thing that he says to the ghost of his own father when he says, "It needs no ghosts come from the grave to tell us this, my liege." I.e., ghosts should say more interesting things than you're telling me. I mean, it's
that's
so...
That's what Horatio says to Hamlet, when Hamlet won't tell
what the ghost said. Yes, yes, that's right, that's right, that's right. So, you know, for me, it's a big, big, big ball of yarn, endlessly wound, that there is nothing that you come to know that will not come to use for you someday or other, if only because you can only use what you know. You can't use what you don't know, right? the only case, and I recommend it as an exercise, write a character much, 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 much smarter than you are without doing research for it. Find out how to give the reader the impression that the character you've made is smarter than the writer. It's very fascinating how this happens. Lewis Carroll has a weird German professor in Sylvian Bruno whose goal in life is to make a map so detailed that 1 inch equals 1 inch. And the German people, when he affects this, are very angry because when unrolled, it blots out the sunlight and nothing can grow. This is what people smarter than we are think of. Next. Oh, please, please, don't do that. Yes.
You interviewed Max Sebald just a number of days before he passed away. It's a beautiful interview in which you talk about Bernhard and German writing and his influences, but I was curious if you'd say a little bit more about
that. I'd be very happy and honored to. It was my honor to speak to Sebald. What are the initials?
WG.
Who was known as Max to friends. I felt for sure that the fuss that people were making about the immigrants, which had to do with the juxtaposition of photograph and text, there are photographs in this book. And some of them are falsified. A passport, in particular, is not the person's passport being written about. And so people came to do ekphrasis. Do you know this word, ekphrasis? There's a whole business in criticism right now about poems, about pictures, and the relation of illustration to text, and things of the sort. I think it's very, very interesting, but interpreters were ekphrasis happy, and they thought that this book by Sebald was centrally about the photographs, because how many other books did you have photographs in? Actually, the answer is plenty, and Thackeray drew illustrations to his children's poem, The Rose and the Ring, and, you know, there are all sorts. Bruno Schultz illustrated his stories. There are all sorts of it. I thought that this had virtually nothing to do with the immigrants. And I thought, how am I going to get around this? Because all sorts of people, including my friend Susan Sontag, were writing essays, and that's all that was about. And I said to him, you know, I don't really think... I have heard of a novel, a kind of novel, known as Das Glück im Winkel, which means happiness in a corner. It is a kind of concept, at least for novel writing, that makes me joyous. I think of Bruno Schultz, although I know he was not a member of the Happiness in a Corner school, as writing this kind of literature. If you haven't read, by the way, Bruno Schultz's The Street of Crocodiles, it's one of the ecstatic experiences. It's a poem. Poets will have a better time with it than novelists, but everyone will love it. He was killed on the street by Nazis, and a lost manuscript called The Messiah never has turned up. Cynthia Ozick wrote a whole novel called The Messiah of Stockholm about the imaginary finding of this manuscript. At any rate, happiness in a corner. And Sebald started to talk to me about German country writing by Grillparzer and others. The interview as aired is only 2/3 of our conversation. I have kept all of the originals, and someday I will make sure that the rest of that interview gets transcribed as frequently as the part that has been transcribed. I'm very proud of that conversation because we were in an ecstasy. We were talking about his novel Asterlitz, and I said that it reminded me of the traditions, once glorious and beautiful, of the writing about insects that was popular among naturalists, but poets as well. Maeterlinck wrote a book called The Life of the Bee. Many, many such books exist. Writers would go in the natural world and describe the things they saw. Writers' notebooks were once filled with this. If you have the opportunity, recently a thing called The Journals of Jules Renard was republished by, what's the name of the literary magazine that's also a press and comes from the Northwest? Tin House. They have a press and they republished the issue, this book of the notebooks of a writer we don't read very much in America, the notebooks of Jules Renard. Often children learning French in America will be given his novel, Poil de Carotte, Carrot Head, to read because it's written in very simplified language, but it's a very beautiful and sophisticated book. He describes things he sees. But not only that, he describes he and his wife bringing his baby to the seashore, and they put the baby on the sand. The baby's wearing a sunsuit, and the baby wriggles its arms and legs, and they put on the suspender of the sunsuit a starfish. And the baby wriggles, and the starfish wriggles. And I just fall apart. I just said, wow. And once when I was in graduate school, very briefly, I taught composition classes, and I thought that people would write much better if they knew how to look at what they see. And so I gave them around 14 pages of the notebooks of Jules Renard to go home with for the first major vacation, Thanksgiving. And I said, it doesn't matter, it's not imitating. See like this. And they all brought in astonishing things. The failure of composition classes is not the failure of the student. As Walter J. Ong, the great Jesuit critic, said, it's the failure of the imagination of the teacher in giving assignments that students cannot do well ever. What did you do on your summer vacation? And Ong says, the student can't even imagine who would they tell this to. Their friends don't care. Their parents were with them. Grandma? Who could you even stand talking to grandma for more than a minute or two? So you're being asked to write down a thing that you can't ever imagine sharing. And that everyone will fail at this except the couple of bright kids who say, teacher likes Huckleberry Finn, teacher likes Catcher in the Rye, I will please teacher by sounding like a cross between Holden Caulfield and Huckleberry. And it was absolutely true. I recognized it. And so, you know, you have to spend time. I had so many exercises that I felt that no students who would, this is the basic thing, who would pay attention, would fail to be interesting in. And once they're interested and proud of the things they've seen and described, they write. It may not be grammatical, but they're eager to learn the grammar to make such a beautiful thing also correct. I get, again, very angry at exercises, writing composition exercises, that do not make the person feel nobler and better by accomplishing them. Sebald. We talked about all these writers. Sebald felt very happy because nowhere in America had anyone any idea of the traditions he came from, because we don't translate those books here. And Stifter, Adalbert Stifter, that was another writer that he admired. And then once he said those to me, I didn't know them either, but I went to read them, because a country novel, I want to find, it's a tradition I don't know. I wanted to, they're translated, but they're just not commonly found. I don't know enough languages, I wish I did. But that was my experience with Sebald. I was so horrified to learn of his death, which was only several months later. And it gave fuel to my terrible feeling that right now the thing we cannot have and will not tolerate in the world for very long is genius. Bolaño, dead before we even knew him in America, so young. Sebald, as we were getting to know him. David Foster Wallace. You know, the writing which had nothing typical or ordinary or comparable to others. We're not going to have our Nabokovs and our Becketts and our Joyces. We are going to have, for best and worse, the commentators on the common. The ecstatically unusual book will not be a thing of our time, and we can only hope that in that day that Hans Magnus Enzensberger mentioned, that guy who said about second order illiteracy, he said that the time will come not too long in which being able to read difficult works will be as unusual as being able to play the piano well or being able to dance classical ballet, but not to worry, because when we meet one another, we will be so happy and grateful to meet another who knows the same thing, that the conversations will be that much profound and that much more delicious because so rare. I don't know whether that's true. I so hope not, or at least not before I go. But it is to be put on record that someone thinks that, a German philosopher, journalist, and poet. Next.
Perhaps,
yes.
Because you were talking about ghosts, and because you brought up Wallace, and because you read everything, it seemed to me in the past few years that contemporary fiction has really been arranging itself around an absence. And have you known before, like, for a writer to turn up so concretely in the works of his contemporaries?
It seems
that every novel must have a Wallace figure, every essay collection must address.
Well, I'll tell you a big secret that I don't believe has been said publicly about David Foster Wallace. I mean, it's like, talking for me is like broad jumping. I always have to figure out at what distance from the starting point I should begin in making the run up to the jumping point. David's deepest hope was to be able to write what he called a hard novel and have it be loved. And you'll notice that running through that hard novel, Infinite Jest, is a voice that we know from a writer who also infiltrated most young writers who'd read him at one point or another. It was J.D. Salinger. The person talking to you, making friends with you, while showing you how different from you he believes he is, the book that I think was designed to make an entire generation turn up at Salinger's unwilling doorstep. The book was designed to make you want to meet a man who didn't want to meet you. It has that paradox inherent in it. He never wanted to meet you. He became more of a recluse over his life, but it wasn't his fans that drove him into reclusion. Anyway, what David figured out was that style of direct address to the reader was the thing that bonded the reader to Catcher in the Rye more than anything else about it. And, of course, having the kind of binary mind, the exploration of the binary that he had, here, the expert tennis player, there, the expert addict, he matches The Catcher in the Rye, which you can't resist, which you find irresistible, with that missing film that everyone is looking for, which will kill you if you see it with pleasure. So, you know, that's the inherent balance. But I think that Salinger was such a writer. While he was living and working, Barthelme was, and Carver. I think that the last 50 or 60 years of writing have been centered around a writer who made a breakthrough and then was so beloved by other writers, by other readers, by the people who studied with him and knew him and drank with him. All of them that I've mentioned, interestingly, I hadn't thought of this before, but candidates for Alcoholics Anonymous, David and Salinger and Carver and Barthelme. I don't know what that has to do with, but addiction and conviviality sometimes go hand in hand. But yes, I do think that writing does arrange itself around an absence center, and it's often better, except for Salinger. All these writers I mentioned died young. I would say, in Donald's case, without having completed a masterwork. Although many, many single and short works of genius. But I was of these dead people closest, most intimate with Donald. And so I had very high expectations for him. And that he died believing that he was burnt out rather than temporarily incommoded was very sad to me. David had a similar, but not exactly the same, belief that he couldn't not only his own depression, but that he couldn't figure out how to prevent the end of reading by providing a book, another book, so emphatically readable. Writers creating hunger for their next work. Salinger. So interesting to me that time went by, and at the time, no one reported whether there are manuscripts left behind. I'll tell you a secret, there are. I have not had access to them, but there are things of Salinger that will be steadily published, and the announcement has not yet been made. But I have it on really believable authority. So one of my dearest questions
can a writer who once had that finger on the pulse of his time, did he have it still when he died? Will these stories be as meaningful to us now as his published works were to us then? If they are, what an astonishing thing that will be. If a writer who wanted, again, to be a be-all and end-all, wouldn't it be amazing if the existence of other Salinger novels made people who thought that they don't like reading want to read like crazy, not be able to wait. And they apparently are scheduled for publication, he determined it, in an order almost like from beyond the grave, receiving the pieces of Dickens's novels the way people did at the docks, the serial novel. I don't know that they're all pieces of the same thing, but I know that he worked out when he wanted them published, and that there's quite a space of time between published sections. But thank you for asking that question, because I think it is very interesting that in a time when community is such a problem, that each of these writers created a community of writing around themselves and their styles that changed a generation of writing.
Wow. And thank you for creating this community. We have a reception
thank you.
And we'd like you to continue the conversation there if we could. Could we thank you so much?
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.